Hello, everyone, and welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger for December 23rd. It's Wednesday, and as I record this, we're in the midst of a blizzard that has hit the Ford Dodge area. We were out and about a little bit ago, and I'm guessing we probably have at least 3 inches of snow so far, and the wind has come up. So it's not real pleasant out, and hopefully by Thursday things will have calmed down. At least I think that's what the forecast is. Looking at the Ford Dodge Messenger, Festive Fundraising is the title of the first article about the Sertoma Young Professionals fundraising efforts with Lights at Kennedy. The glittering displays of Lights at Kennedy were a record-breaking attraction this year. A total of 4,206 vehicles cruised past the brightly lighted Christmas decorations in John F. Kennedy Memorial Park north of Fort Dodge. Andy Reid, an organizer of the display, said this year's attendance, quote, crushed every record. The event yielded just over $29,000 in donations, another record. That money will be divided between the Fort Dodge Noon Sertoma Club and the Fort Dodge Young Professionals, the two groups that organized the event. There were 28 displays set up that people could gaze at as their vehicles slowly rolled through the park. It was pretty amazing the support that we got, Reid said. We wanted to do it as bad as the community wanted it, apparently. Lights at Kennedy has been a holiday tradition for 17 years. This year it was open for viewing on the first 3 weekends of December, and it did not take long for people to show up. According to Reid, on the first night, 587 vehicles came through. That topped the record of 505 vehicles set December 22, 2019. But that 2020 opening night record was just the beginning. Reid said on December 12th there were 654 cars at Lights at Kennedy. Last Saturday there were 740 vehicles, and on Sunday there were 623 vehicles, he reported. The total vehicles for the 3 weekends was 4,206. The total number of vehicles in 2019 was 2,844. Reid speculated that the massive turnout was because it was an event that we could still have even with COVID, and the fact people were looking for something to do. Donations received at Lights at Kennedy will be allocated a little differently this time. In the past, the money went to Backpack Buddies, a Fort Dodge Noon Sertoma Club initiative that fills the school backpacks of qualifying children with nutritious food every Friday so the kids have something good to eat over the weekends. Backpack Buddies will still benefit, but money will also be earmarked for other club projects, such as Veterans Memorial Park. The club will also reinvest in its display at the event. Fort Dodge Young Professionals will use some of the money to help provide low-cost events to help gain and retain young professionals in the area. Back to the main page of the Messenger, waiting for the computer to load the next story. County supervisors have finalized a county mask mandate. The enforcement teeth, however, was removed prior to passage. A mask mandate passed in a split vote Tuesday by Webster County supervisors brought the county in line with a similar mandate passed by the city of Fort Dodge in November. The regulation, first drafted and passed by the Webster County Board of Health December 3rd, requires masks or face coverings to be worn at all times in most indoor public locations, regardless of how long one is inside or how close one is to others. Tightening the more permissive language of a November mask mandate issued by Governor Kim Reynolds, it would also require use of masks outdoors when 6 feet of distance cannot be maintained from others. The new rules passed with a 3-2 vote. Supervisors Nikki Conrad, Nick Carlson, and Bob Thode voted in favor, while Supervisors Mark Campbell and Keith Dinklaw dissented. This is an extension of what the city of Fort Dodge passed, Carlson said. There is no enforcement to this as of now. Notable exceptions to the law extend to those eating or drinking at a restaurant, those exercising, residents in a personal vehicle, and those participating in religious or spiritual gatherings, including weddings and funerals. A previous draft of the public health regulation stirred uproar among the business owners who learned that they would be subject to civil penalties of up to $750 for the first offense and up to $1,000 for subsequent offenses for flouting enforcement of the new rules in their establishments. That provision was suspended in the Board of Health's Thursday meeting, but the remainder of the mandate, okayed by supervisors Tuesday, is now in effect. But the county regulation, rendered toothless with its enforcement mechanism suspended, was not put into law Tuesday without some choice words from constituents. "This is an illegitimate resolution," said resident Reggie Simmons, arguing the county had no authority to override the governor's mandate with more restrictive rules. "The county cannot usurp the governor. I will do everything I can do to vote you out if you vote for this." Simmons' comments reflected similarly harsh opposition expressed by residents during the Board of Health's meeting Thursday to remove business penalties from the protocol. In previous meetings this month, County Attorney Darren Driscoll outlined the provisions of Iowa law and Reynolds' early November order that made local restrictions not only compatible but legally permissible. Though cities and counties cannot write local regulations inconsistent with the governor's order, they are allowed to strengthen mask requirements to help calm local COVID-19 outbreaks. An inconsistent local regulation would be if the governor imposed a mask mandate for all people, and the Board of Health then decided we don't believe in masks and passed a regulation saying it's illegal to wear a mask, Driscoll said Thursday. "What we are doing here, in my opinion, is complementary to what the governor is doing." Two others spoke in favor of the protocol Tuesday, even if they wished it went further. "It's better than having nothing," said Megan Secor, co-owner of Soldier Creek Winery and an organizer of a petition that helped bring mask mandates to the city and county. "As a business owner and community member, this needs to happen. While it clearly won't make everybody happy, it will positively help our community," Conrad said before voting. The Board of Health's thinking behind imposing penalties on businesses rather than individuals for violations was based in consideration for law enforcement officers. Previously, board members hoped the need for enforcement could be balanced by removing the impetus for a flood of complaints on individual violators. But the civil penalty for businesses deliberately ignoring the rules could be reinstated at a later date by the Board of Health and Supervisors. The board previously said it would revisit enforcement mechanisms at a later date, likely at least a month from now, if necessary, though no language in the regulation stipulates what might trigger a bite from those enforcement teeth. Board members said the county's positivity rate and burns at local health care institutions would be valuable metrics in making the determination. Those with questions, comments, or observations about the new county mask mandate can direct their calls to Webster County's Public Health Special Mask Hotline at 515-227-7155. Where masks are now required in Webster County includes grocery stores, pharmacies, and retail stores, common areas of businesses open to the public, county buildings, public settings not part of one's residence. Outdoors, unless a minimum of 6 feet distance is maintained from others at all times, public transportation and private car services including taxis, rideshare, and carpooling. Where masks are not required, in a personal vehicle, while a person is at home, while exercising at moderate or high intensity, such as jogging and biking, while seated at a food establishment in the process of eating or drinking, while obtaining a service that requires temporary removal of a face covering, when federal or state law prohibits wearing a face covering or requires its removal. Who is not required to wear masks? Children younger than 3. Anyone with a medical condition such as oxygen therapy or a ventilator that would be impeded by wearing a face mask. Dr. Kelly Wallace, medical director for Webster County Public Health, noted there are truly very few valid exemptions for masks. Anyone who is unconscious, incapacitated, or unable to remove their face covering without assistance. Athletes participating in sporting or recreational events. Anyone who has been explicitly told by a medical, legal, or behavioral health professional not to wear a mask, public safety providers such as law enforcement and firefighters, anyone removing their face covering to verify their identity for lawful purposes. If you have any questions after reading this list of requirements, you may call again to Webster County Public Health Special Mask Hotline at 515-227-7155. Back to the main page of the Messenger. Supervisors were busy as now they've okayed mental health region and clock tower project agreements. That will be the next article in the from the Messenger. Webster County supervisors approved agreements Tuesday to finalize the county's move to another mental health and disability services region and grant more time and funding to complete the county courthouse's clock tower and roof restoration project. Central Iowa Community Services will start next summer. A 28E agreement with Central Iowa Community Services approved by supervisors will take effect at the start of the next fiscal year on July 1st, cementing the county's departure from Waterloo-based county social services. Webster County will join the region's other county members, Boone, Franklin, Green, Hamilton, Hardin, Jasper, Madison, Marshall, Poweshiek, Story, and Warren. Effective July 1st, CICS will also add Cerro Gordo County and Wright County. Thanks to legislation passed earlier this year, Webster County was able to gain admittance to the new region in October. The new legislation also allowed the county to take $1.6 million in reserve funds with the move. The new region already has a few mental health services that Webster County has not had access to through CSS, in addition to more established services like a mental health mobile crisis response unit to help lead the way for similar fledgling services started recently in the county. Regarding the clock tower and roof restoration project, supervisors approved a supplemental agreement granting Des Moines-based contractor Chuck Britson Incorporated an additional $150,000 for services to complete the county courthouse's clock tower and roof restoration project. Initially slated for completion this month, the agreement will extend construction to July 30th with continuous work or August 27th with two-month winter shutdown in work. The new funding for the project, initially contracted at a cost of $6.16 million with Des Moines contractor Newman Brothers Incorporated, will help cover construction administration services and unanticipated costs from delays like poor weather, said Supervisor Nick Carlson. Carlson said the scope of the project turned out to be larger than anticipated when it started in March. When finished, the project will have fixed extensive damage and century-old aging around the clock tower, with a partial replacement of its iconic green patina sheathing, as well as a fiberglass skylight that left the building's interior lit with a yellow tint. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, looking for our next article, Fort Dodge Hospital workers will benefit from a pay raise. That is the title of the next article in today's Messenger. Hundreds of hospital workers at Unity Point Health Fort Dodge will benefit from a pay hike announced by the healthcare company last week. Unity Point Health is raising its minimum pay rate from $13 per hour to $15 per hour. Leah Glasgow, president and CEO of Unity Point Health Fort Dodge, said it was an important step to recognize the importance of frontline workers. We are grateful to be able to recognize our team members in this way, Glasgow said. We know that their financial health contributes to their overall health and well-being. We are tying those things together. Embracing this connection is one of the many important steps toward building healthier communities. According to Glasgow, 162 workers will have their pay increased to $15 an hour. Another 197 employees who were already making $15 per hour will see a pay increase also. There's about 1,100 employees who work in the Unity Point Health Fort Dodge region. That includes rural clinics in places like Eagle Grove, Pocahontas, and Sac City. Throughout the entire Unity Point Health system, the pay raise will impact nearly 33% of its more than 30,000 team members. Glasgow said the hospital has been on a mission to bump the minimum pay rate up to $15. We have been on a journey to get to the $15, she said. Last year we transitioned up to $13. Although the increase has been in the works for a long time, the pandemic has reinforced just how important our frontline workers are, so we made the decision to speed up the rate of pay. The additional funds are coming out of the Unity Point Health Operations budget. It's a budgeted business decision, Glasgow said. We budgeted this for this upcoming year. It's not coming from any outside sources. It's coming from within Unity Point Health. Shannon McQuillan, Unity Point Health Fort Dodge Vice President of People Excellence, said offering competitive wages will help the hospital with recruitment and retention. It's a really important step for us in retention strategies for our team members, so they know how important they are, McQuillan said. It's also recruitment for physicians coming to the area and knowing how much we value our team. This will be a really key strategy to retain and recruit high-quality employees. McQuillan added, we all know how difficult it is when a good employee leaves and the impact it has on a department. If it helps us retain employees, we are excited to do it. The new pay rates will go into effect January 17th. One person is dead as a result of a head-on collision that took place over near Rockwell City. One woman is dead following a head-on collision between a car and semi near the intersection of Iowa Highway 4 and 220th Street in Calhoun County Tuesday, according to Iowa State Patrol crash reports. Rose Calamine, age 28, of Jackson, Minnesota, was pronounced dead at the scene. The crash was reported at 3:22 p.m. on Tuesday. According to the Iowa State Patrol, Calamine was driving a Pontiac Bonneville northbound around a curve. At the same time, a semi-trailer was being driven southbound around the curve by Gary Hayes II, age 56, of West Des Moines. Calamine's vehicle crossed the center line and struck the semi head-on, according to crash reports. The Iowa State Patrol reported that she was ejected from the vehicle. Hayes was uninjured. The Iowa State Patrol was assisted by the Iowa Department of Transportation, Calhoun County Sheriff's Office, Rockwell City Firefighters, Litton Firefighters, and the Calhoun County Emergency Medical Service. Back to the main page of the Messenger, checking on more news. A teen was shot in the foot on Monday in Fort Dodge. That will be the title of the next article. Fort Dodge police are investigating a shot fired Monday evening that left a 17-year-old with a foot wound. Officers were dispatched to the 1100 block of 6th Avenue North in reference to someone being shot at approximately 7:40 p.m. Upon arrival, they learned that the victim had been transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center by a private vehicle. After finding the teenager shot in the foot at the hospital, officers learned that he had been speaking with a family member in the alley near the reported location when a gun the relative was holding was discharged. Little information was provided to law enforcement as to the exact timeline of those events, and we are still working to piece that together to determine exactly what happened, said Captain Ryan Grunberg, public information officer. At this point, we do not have enough information to determine whether this was an accidental discharge or something more. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, and we'll click on the More Local News link and see what is next. 12 Days of Christmas is featured. There's a picture of a large house with all sorts of reindeer and more candy canes, wreaths, and trees. This house is shown at is on display rather at 1332 2nd Avenue North. From lighted wreaths and candy canes to Santa Claus and his reindeer, this collection is sure to bring out the Christmas of those who drive by this house. And that is the continuation of the Messenger's 12 Days of Christmas. Prairie Lakes Area Education Agency has computer science grant has been received from the state. The Prairie Lakes Area Education Agency recently received a $68,300 grant from the state to expand computer science instruction in the area's K-12 schools. The grant, awarded by Governor Kim Reynolds, comes from the state's Computer Science Professional Development Incentive Fund. PLEA received one of 18 awards given out across the state to school districts, non-public schools, and area education agencies this year, totaling $883,000+. The grant will fund a partnership between PLEA and Drake University in Des Moines to offer three courses for university credit: computer science methods, computer science in the elementary classroom, and introduction to computer science. It can be difficult for our rural schools to find a teacher who has a strong background in computer science, said Tori Proctor, the PLEA consultant who is coordinating the partnership. There will be 20 participants for each class, and registration will open soon. A stipend will pay for the class and credit for the teachers participating. This grant is important because this will encourage teachers to take a university-level computer science methods course that they may not have, and then the credit from the course that they take, if they choose to do so, could also go down the path of getting an endorsement in computer science, Proctor said. The end goal of the program is to provide better computer science education to Iowa students. It's empowering teachers to empower their students, Proctor said. Back to the main page of the Messenger. Webster County COVID-19 deaths are up 380% in 2 months, is the title of the next article in today's Messenger. As the positivity rate continues to slowly drop in December, the death toll for victims of COVID-19 continues to hit new heights in Webster County. In less than 2 months, the number of people who died of the coronavirus nearly quadrupled from 15 deaths on October 27th to 57 deaths by Tuesday. Since December 5th alone, the count has grown from 39 to 57 deaths. Death tolls for Webster County were reflected on the following dates in the Messenger. October 27th, 15 deaths. November 6th, 17 deaths. November 12th, 20 deaths. December 5th, 39 deaths. December 11th, 47 deaths. December 22nd, 57 deaths. Webster County Public Health has reported 114 new COVID-19 cases since Friday, bringing the county's cumulative caseload to 4,498 as of Tuesday. A total of 185 residents' cases remain open under public health monitoring. The county's rolling positivity rate, the proportion of those tested who received positive results over the last 2 weeks, dropped again slightly from 16.1% on Friday to 15.8% Tuesday. COVID-19 testing remains available at multiple sites in Webster County, including Unity Point Health. They tell you to call your primary care provider, Community Health Center Fort Dodge. Call ahead for urgent, routine, or COVID-19 rapid testing to make an appointment. That number is 515-576-6500. Iowa Specialty Clinic, you're encouraged to call ahead at 515-955-6767 for COVID-19 rapid testing. Patients at the Iowa Specialty Clinic must be symptomatic to receive testing. Webster County Public Health does not conduct testing, but analyzes and acts on the testing information provided by medical providers before implementing U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance and contact tracing as necessary. The agency asks those without health insurance in need of testing to advise their scheduler when making an appointment. If you're awaiting test results, the Public Health Department said it is imperative to self-quarantine until receipt of the test results. Webster County Public Health's COVID hotline remains available to residents with questions regarding COVID-19, including quarantine, isolation, guidance, and exposures. The hotline is available by phone at 515-227-7153. The Community Health Center Fort Dodge COVID testing site will be closed on Thursday and Friday for the Christmas holiday. The testing site will be open again on Saturday. The site will also be closed on January 1st for the New Year's holiday and open on January 2nd. The Fort Dodge site offers dual testing for both COVID-19 and influenza. The drive-through testing is by appointment only and takes place at 2031 Quail Avenue, the East Campus of Iowa Central Community College. To schedule an appointment, go online to chcfb.com. That's chcfb.com. I'll click next on the news of record as we scroll through the different offerings of the newspaper from today. The news of record for December 23rd, 2020, from Magistrate Court in Webster County on Tuesday, introducing intoxicants or drugs into an institution. Understanding Marshall, 37, of Fort Dodge, preliminary hearing waived and transferred to district court. Leaving the scene of an accident, Demetrius Foy, 29, of Fort Dodge, hearing set for January 15th. Gary Andrews, of 48, continued to Wednesday. No insurance in an accident, Demetrius Foy, 29 at Fort Dodge, hearing set for January 15th, and Gary Andrews, Jr., 48, no address given for Gary, continued to Wednesday. Employee selling tobacco to minor Julie Bethel of Otho, fined $175. Alejandro Galvin of Fort Dodge, fined $175. Grishka Suarez Romero of Fort Dodge, hearing set for January 15th. Dinesh Andon, that was continued to December 23rd. Driving under suspension, Jeremiah James of McCallsburg, fined $347.50. Larry Laughlin of Fort Dodge, also fined $347.50. Driving while barred against Gary Andrews Jr., 48, that was also continued to Wednesday. The police log in Fort Dodge on Monday, one domestic call was reported. A car accident was reported in the 700 block of South 17th Street. Criminal mischief in the 2400 block of 2nd Avenue North. Criminal mischief in the 1500 block of North 28th Street. A tobacco violation in the 700 block of 1st Avenue South. A structure fire in the 10 block of South 15th Street. A burglary in the 100 block of Exposition Drive. Harassment in the 1600 block of 5th Avenue South and the 900 block of Central Avenue. Theft in the 2500 block of 22nd Avenue North. A person with a weapon in the 1000 block of Williams Drive. Shots fired in the 1100 block of 6th Avenue North. Juvenile problems in the 2200 block of 10th Avenue North. And a suspicious vehicle in the 1200 block of 1st Avenue South. That is the news of record from Webster County Magistrate Court and the Fort Dodge Police Department. From our files today features a picture of Curtis B. Olson as he spends a little time with his son Curtis on his first in town as they go out for dinner at Third Base Sports Bar and Grill. PFC Olson, who was with the Iowa Army National Guard, 1st Battalion, 194th Field Artillery, which had just returned from Mississippi where they were training for an upcoming mission in Iraq, was getting to spend the holidays at home with his family. And that's from our files going back to December of 2005. We will look next at arrivals. These are from Iowa Specialty Hospital. Michaela and Jesse Anderson of Webster City welcomed a boy named Henry Allen Anderson, born December 2nd. Grandparents are Mike and Mindy Prusman and Jeff and Chris Anderson. Great-grandparents are Paul Prusman, Ken and Kathy McMillan, and Carol Ike. Carissa and Ben Everson of Webster City welcomed a boy named Franklin Estes Everson, born December 9th. Grandparents are Dick and Rosine Kennedy, Keith and Mona Everson. Great-grandmothers are Trudy Mae Larson and Ione Cott. Virginia and Patrick Kenny of Webster City welcomed a boy named James Thomas Kenny, born December 12th. Grandparents are Angela Pelton, Jason and Melissa Trinkle, Jim and Kathy Kenny, and the late Allison Kenny. Great-grandparents are Wyetta Devilbiss, Vicky Coop, and Darwin Pelton. Outside the area, Aaron and Sean Handelin of Cylinder welcome a boy, Anders Paul Handelin, born November 27th. Grandparents are Brent and Kathy Taylor, and Mike and Linda Handelin. Tim and Tori Flattery of West Des Moines welcome a boy named Fitzpatrick Hans Flattery, born December 9th. Grandparents are Dave and Debbie Flattery, Jeff and Judy Scarpinato. Great-grandparents are Hans and Darlene Flattery. And those are the recent arrivals from Iowa Specialty Hospital and outside of the area. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we will bring you to you today's obituary page. Betty Johnson. Betty Jane Raymond Johnson, 86, of Fort Dodge, died December 19th at the Paula J. Baber Hospital. Betty was born September 29th, 1994, to Frank Raymond and Amelia Katisbeck Lanning She is preceded in death by her parents and her siblings, Dorothy Porter, Helen Welchel, Frank Raymond Jr., Maxine Oberhelman, and Nancy Mabe, and her son, William Woolley Farmer. She is survived by her son, Phil and Kathy Farmer Sr., and four grandchildren, Tina and Gage Hendrickson, Philip Farmer Jr., Ashley and Matt Hansen, and Stephen Farmer. She also leaves behind four great-grandchildren, Ashley, Seth, Sunshine, and Violet, and her very special black lab, Molly. Family meant everything to Betty. Her two sons were her pride and joy. She adored all her grandchildren and loved spending time with them. Betty enjoyed playing cards and bingo, volunteering, and being a foster grandma to many. Anyone who knew Betty knew she was a feisty one. In the words of her great-grandchildren, she was one who never failed to make crazy memories and create laughter at any given moment. She will be forever missed. Cremation rites will take place with Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Due to COVID, a celebration of life is being planned for a later date. Glenda R. Harms. Glenda R. Harms, 58, of Fort Dodge, died Monday, December 21st at Trinity Regional Medical Center. The private family service that was planned for Monday has been postponed. A public celebration of life and memorial service will be held at a later date. Glenda's full obituary is forthcoming, and Laufisweiler Severs Funeral Home is serving the family. So just to update that, services for Glenda Harms have been postponed for the time being. I know a lot of people knew Glenda here in town. Nancy Crandall, 78, of Fort Dodge, died Monday, December 21st on her birthday. She was married to Bob Crandall. Family includes son Blake Crandall and his wife Mary, grandchildren Seth, Nick, and Shane, great-grandchildren Charlotte, Margot, and Riley James. No services will be held. Mickey Silbaugh, 65, of Humboldt, passed away Saturday, December 19th at Trinity Regional Medical Center. Family will have a private service on Saturday, December 26th at the Congregational United Church of Christ in Humboldt. Mason Linhart Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Clarion, Terry M. Evans, 81, of Clarion, died Tuesday, December 22nd at his winter home in Chandler, Arizona. Funeral arrangements are pending at Ewing Funeral Home in Clarion. LaDonna Gugisberg, 79, of Eagle Grove, died the 21st. Services will be at 11 o'clock on January 4th at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. And that, again, is an update. Services were previously scheduled for LaDonna Gugisberg on Monday, December 28th. That service has been postponed to Monday, January 4th at 11 o'clock at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. And that is the extent of today's obituary page. Turning over to sports, Lead by Example is the title of an article in today's sports section. Lear Thorson is working through a senior year like none other as a member of the Iowa State University Swimming Program. The 2017 Fort Dodge Senior High graduate continues to navigate a fluid schedule altered by the COVID-19 global pandemic, which arrived shortly after last February's Big 12 championships. Head coach Dwayne Sorensen, Cyclones have improvised and prepared for the new look 2021 campaign, which is slated to begin next month and continued as scheduled into March. In order to get there, Thorson, a first-team All-Big 12 performer a year ago, knows discipline and leadership are more imperative than ever before. To her, setting the right example means making sure she's following the rules and safety precautions established by the school and local health officials. It's going to sound like a strange answer, but part of being a leader right now is fellowship, said Thorson, also a two-time first-team all-academic all-conference selection for the Cyclones. As a team, we are focused on controlling what we can. There is an order to all this if we want to make it work, and we can't let any selfish or personal reasons get in the way. So I'm focused on taking the rules established by the school, or the coaches, or the community, or health experts, and walk the walk. Anything from wearing masks on the pool deck to being careful when we're away from the facilities and on our own. I feel like my job is to help the team make things as easy as possible for coaches and officials. If we want to have a full season in the coming months, we have to really concentrate being consistent with following the proper protocol. These are conversations and expectations Thorson couldn't have ever imagined having taken. Imagine after taking second place in the 100 breaststroke and third in the 200 breaststroke at the Big 12 Championships last February. The former Dodger All-Stater has never been one to dwell on the negative or look too far into the past, though. Thorson's goal in this new world is to make the most of every opportunity moving forward. It's definitely put everything into a different perspective, she said. She registered 14 top three breaststroke meet performances as a junior. We're really trying to come together as a team more than ever. We talked about goals and expectations through periods of quarantine when all hope for a 2021 campaign seemed to be lost. Now that we could potentially have what could be considered a normal January schedule, we're embracing the simplicity of being able to function in a live meet environment again. We want to be able to look back and say we put our heads down, did the right things, worked hard, and got through it. The Iowa State program held a three-day Cyclone Championship Intersquad event at Beyer Pool earlier this month. Thorson captured both breaststroke championships with times of 102.58 in the 100 and 218.38 in the 200. We've been kind of simulating our regular schedule with virtual meets all year, Thorson said, of a campaign that usually starts in late October. This was our mid-season meet, and the coaches wanted to give us a real feel in the same opportunities we normally get in a live setting. I was kind of a stick in the mud about it at first, but it ended up being really fun and competitive. We made the most of it, and the entire experience was very rewarding. I thought maybe I needed other schools and opponents to make it feel real, but I was wrong. We got a lot out of it and enjoyed being in a meet situation. Thompson added she has a newfound respect for everything the coaching staff and athletic department has gone through just to get Cyclone athletes back in action. We're just so thankful, Thorson said. The work they put into everything from this meet and the necessary protocols all the way back to the off-season of preparing workouts and keeping us all on the same page, I'm not sure we ever fully appreciated it until now. For me, more than ever, I've also learned how important the team aspect of swimming is. Even though it's an individual sport on the surface, it wasn't the same to work alone. Once we all came back together, you really see the value in teamwork for both physical and emotional support. When everyone is going through the same thing, it makes you realize how important it is to be a part of a program. Thorson is on a track to graduate this spring and plans to pursue a master's degree in mass communications and journalism. Iowa State's first meet in 2021 will be January 16th in Omaha. The 2021 Big 12 Championships are slated for February 24th through the 27th in Austin, Texas. The NCAA Championships are scheduled for March 17th through the 20th in Greensboro, North Carolina. The Fort Dodge boys basketball team finally gets on the board with a win. The Fort Dodge boys basketball team upped their defensive intensity to earn their first victory of the season at Carlisle on Tuesday, 44-38. The Dodgers are 1-3 overall for the season. They pulled away late to finally shake free from the Wildcats, who are 1-4, a rare Class 3A opponent for head coach Tom Daniels' squad. Junior Carson Peterson scored 15 points to pace Fort Dodge. I thought turning defense into offense was the key, Daniels said. We still have a lot to figure out and some things to work through, but it was good to see a more productive commitment on the defensive end. This was a step in the right direction and the type of Dodger basketball that needs to be played. Fort Dodge jumped ahead 10-5 at the end of the first quarter and extended the lead to 6 by halftime. Carlisle made a run midway through the final period and got within a point, but the Dodgers closed the door late. Senior Avery Martin added 9 points in the win and junior Drake Callen chipped in 8. Fort Dodge is back in action against Ames at home on Tuesday, January 5th. The Fort Dodge girls basketball team rallied past Carlisle Tuesday night. Junior Jalen Adams made a driving layup on a fast break with 9 seconds left in regulation and that proved to be the game winner as the Fort Dodge girls basketball team held off Carlisle Tuesday night 39-37. The shorthanded Dodgers, 2-3 overall, struggled to find their rhythm offensively, but a 9-0 run to end the third period erased an 8-point deficit, and head coach Scott Messerly's squad held on the rest of the way. It was a tough game, Messerly said. We went to a 1-2-1-1 press in the second half, which got us going and helped us come back. We didn't have second leading scorer Aaliyah Palmer, who was out sick, so other girls had to step up. Jalen and Ellie White were big for us, especially in the press and with their half-court defense, and Tristan Doster came up big again, both scoring-wise and on the boards. Doster finished with a double-double, scoring 12 points and pulling down 12 rebounds. Adams and senior Cheyenne Miller-Hamid both added 7 points, with sophomore Peyton Hively contributing 6. The Wildcats were down 5 in the last minute. They were 0-1-5 in the season. They were down 5 in the last minute, but rallied and eventually tied the score before Adams' basket on a breakaway. Carlisle had a chance to tie and force overtime, but a layup attempt in the closing seconds rimmed in and out. The Wildcats led at halftime 23-19 and by as many as 8 points at 30-22 before the Dodgers started their comeback. Fort Dodge girls returns to action also on January 5th against Ames at home. We will take a look next at the Webster City Freeman Journal. Oath of office was given to a variety of county office holders. Recently, Senior Judge James McGlynn administered the oath of office to 4 newly elected county office holders Tuesday morning during the Board of Supervisors meeting. Kim Shea, County Auditor, Doug Timmons, Sheriff, Jerry Cloverdance, Board of Supervisors, and Dan Campadilli, Board of Supervisors, were all sworn in, but their terms of office will not begin until January. Shea, Timmons, and Campadilli were all re-elected, while Cloverdance was elected to fill the seat currently held by Doug Bailey. An honor and pleasure to serve, speaking of Doug Bailey. Bailey offers remarks on his retirement from Board of Supervisors. Doug Bailey, who has served as a Hamilton County Supervisor for the past 16 years and as chairman this past year, chaired his last regular meeting of the board Tuesday morning. Bailey decided not to seek re-election to the office and will conclude his duties with the county at the end of the calendar year. Several of the county office holders offered words of thanks to Bailey. With a grateful heart, I want to thank you, Doug. You've been a champion in my corner of the world since I started here. We've served on many committees together and working towards making life better for the most vulnerable in our county, said Patty Treble Leeds, Director of County Social Services. County Auditor Kim Shea thanked Bailey for his years of service and leadership. Supervisor Dan Campadilli said his fellow board member was patient and answered the many questions he had as a new office holder. I was so comfortable working with him, I'm going to miss our conversations, Campadilli said. Bailey also offered some thoughts on his years in office. He talked about former supervisors Wes Sweetler and David Young, two men that he said had mentored him as he joined the board. Fair is where you take a pig to earn a ribbon. That scolding and warning was shared often by Wes Sweetler, one of the fair human beings I've ever met, he said. Bailey said David Young often reminded him that the chairman always has the last word. He would tell me that in years that I served as chair, especially when he thought I needed to say something that I wasn't going to say. Bailey said he took some time last week to look at some of the old supervisors' minute books, and turned to the December 1918 board meetings. 102 years ago, Hamilton County, along with the rest of the country, had just suffered through the 1918 flu epidemic and World War I, which had ended the month before. He was looking for a nugget of inspiration or a bit of hope from those days that might translate as encouragement for the current conditions of the world. Back in 1918, the Board of Supervisors met once a month over the course of several days. Bailey said on that December agenda were issues that county officials still deal with. The first day was spent all on drainage, he said. The late 1800s to the early 1920s was the glory days of the massive agricultural drainage system we have in the county. The second day, the meeting opened with a drainage request. There is a resolution to reimburse the Webster City Chamber of Commerce for handling the County Food Administration in the amount of $50 per month. Also on at the meeting, refund bonds were authorized for the purpose of redeeming outstanding warrants in the county road and bridge funds with a $4 premium per $1,000 for bonds, Rimlong, 5 years and bearing a 5% interest rate, Bailey noted. The 1918 board also paid the county's claims, including $25.80 for the shoes for the county home, $24.45 for gravel for the county road between Webster City and Duncombe, and a lumber company was issued $3.40 for bridge repair. In those minutes, the supervisors, he said, found nothing about the Spanish flu or the end of World War I. There is no nugget of inspiration or one-liner on hope for the future, but what I discovered is what I already knew. While the dollars are greater and some of the tasks are different, local government continues to provide the mundane day-to-day paperwork, physical labor process, and systems by which our residents go about living their lives. Bailey said that it was in the continuity and stability through the decades that he found hope for the future. Local government provides the ground-level framework for our residents to secure their unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, he said. Regardless of the leadership displayed at the state and federal levels, Bailey said local government carries on. He pointed to the various office holders in attendance at the meeting, ticking off the many ways the elected officials would help county residents. Shelby Cruna is going to make sure that every resident in the county who wants a COVID-19 vaccine is going to get one. Ryan Wiedemann, the county engineer, is going to make sure the snow gets plowed off the roads. Doug Timmons, the sheriff, is going to make sure travelers on those roads are safe and secure. He also thanked his two fellow supervisors, Dan Campidelli and Rick Young. I'm going to miss their day-to-day banter, humor, and counsel more than I'm sure I realize right now, he said. Bailey said that Jerry Clobbernauts of Webster City, who was elected to fill his seat, will fit in perfectly. It has been my honor and pleasure to serve on the board and to work with some very dedicated public servants who are spread throughout our county government who have made me proud each and every day, Bailey said. He closed by thanking the residents of Hamilton County for giving him the opportunity to serve. The vaccine has arrived in Hamilton County as Cruna updates supervisors and outlines vaccination plans. The much-anticipated Moderna COVID-19 vaccine arrived in Hamilton County Tuesday, according to officials with Hamilton County Public Health. Shelby Cruna, the public health administrator, spoke about the vaccine procedures Tuesday during the Board of Supervisors meeting. First to be vaccinated will be frontline healthcare workers and those living in long-term care facilities. She said her agency was splitting its allotment with Van Deese Medical Center. Van Deese Medical Center will vaccinate staff members involved in direct patient care at the hospital and family health clinic. Public health will vaccinate its frontline workers and healthcare workers in the county's smaller clinics. She added that the federal pharmacy program will handle vaccinations for long-term and assisted living facilities. Cruna said the vaccine will be free to all who choose to receive it. However, all facilities will be charging an administration fee to Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance companies. People will be asked to bring in their insurance, Medicare, or Medicaid cards. If you don't have insurance, do not worry. We'll still have the vaccine available for you, she said. Cruna also gave a COVID-19 update for the county. As of Tuesday, 6,012 people have been tested for the virus in Hamilton County. Of that total, 4,603 have tested negative, 1,405 had to have positive test results since reporting began in April. Currently, the 14-day positivity rate for Hamilton County is 19.5%. We're seeing activity in all zip codes of the county, she said. There is still wide community spread. The days to double, the time required to double the number of cases, has decreased to 42. That's still a very short period of time, but we're seeing movement in the right direction. Our fear is what will happen after Christmas gatherings take place. The healthcare system in Iowa is close to full and very busy and very stressed. Cruna said that testing had fallen off quite a bit in the county. That does not mean the virus is not around. In November, we were having anywhere from 45 to 145 people take a COVID test, she said. The last 2 weeks have averaged 20 or fewer a day. I realize that some people have decided that if they have symptoms, they aren't going to test, but that diminishes our ability to say how widespread it is in our community. It also means that people don't end up on the contact tracing list, so there's more spread going on under the radar, according to Kruna. The largest percentage of cases falls within the 19 to 24-year-old range group with a 10% positivity rate. The 30 to 34 age group and the 45 to 49 age group have 9% positivity rates. Those are spreaders. We're seeing a lot of families spread within those households. There have been 21 deaths in Hamilton County attributed to COVID-19. The majority of those deaths occurred in November, she said. There is a letter to the editor in the Freeman Journal. Sheridan Thinks Community is the title. To the editor, I would like to publicly offer my heartfelt thanks to the citizens of Webster City for the privilege of serving as your city manager. I would also like to thank the city staff for their hard work and dedication. It was an honor to serve you, and that is submitted by Jeff Sheridan of Webster City. Looking real quickly at Webster City sports, it was an unusual feeling for Webster City head boys basketball coach Marty McKinney as he attempted to digest his team's first loss of the season Friday night. Usually following a setback, he can pinpoint a number of things that went wrong, but that just wasn't the case as he sat in an empty and quiet Webster City High School gym. The truth was he was pretty pleased with how the Lynx performed. From where we were a week ago to where we were last Tuesday to where we were on Friday, the improvement was just huge. He said following the 61-56 disappointment against Algona, "We are really disappointed we didn't win that game and nobody is satisfied, but if we keep the attitude and mindset that we had in this game, there are a lot of good things ahead for us." Unbeaten in North Central Conference play, Algona went ahead to stay 53-52 with a three-pointer from the right wing with 2:25 remaining. It was Nelson's second triple of the quarter and fourth of the game as he led the Bulldogs with 16 points. Algona knocked down 8 straight free throws over the final 48 seconds to keep the Lynx at bay. In the girls' contest that evening, Algona staged a furious rally to stun the Webster City Lynx as the girls let a 13-point lead slip away in the fourth quarter. Leah Cash didn't hang out on the bench for long in the fourth quarter Friday night, maybe 45 seconds to a minute of game time, but she spent the majority of the break with her head in her hands. The Webster City senior couldn't believe it was happening again. Head coach Nicole Molenbrook was experiencing the same frustrating deja vu, sitting just 2 seats down. 3 days after losing a 6-point lead with just over 3 minutes remaining against 15th-ranked Hampton Dumont Cal, the Lynx saw a 13-point fourth-quarter lead and another chance to crack into the win column evaporate against previously winless Algona inside the Webster City Gymnasium. "We panicked. We didn't take a breath, gather ourselves, and do what we should do. We talked in the locker room afterward about how you've got to be mentally tough in the fourth quarter, but we weren't tough enough to hold the lead." Looking at the weather forecast, we're going to get through our snowstorm that we're currently having. I'm taking a look at the weather radar, and it probably will be done snowing, I imagine, within the next couple of hours in Fort Dodge. And like I said earlier, we probably had about 3 or 4 inches of snow that had started to pile up. On Thursday, there's still a slight chance of snow with a high of only 12 degrees. That's Christmas Eve, of course. Christmas Day looks nice, 30 degrees and sunny. 36 and partly sunny on Saturday, 28 mostly cloudy on Sunday, 15 and mostly sunny on Monday. Snow chances return next week. Tuesday, a 30% chance of light snow, high of 21. Wednesday, high of 27 with a 40% chance of light snow. Next Thursday looks interesting. An 80% chance of a frozen mix, talking about high of only 20 degrees, warming up to 22 on Friday, and windy conditions return. That is going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger. Of course, this podcast and others are available at the iowaradioreading.org website. And of course, we encourage you to listen to our podcasts, and we appreciate your support of IRIS. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you again real soon. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, and take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.